The Folklife Festival, as you may know, is produced by the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. Our co-sponsor is the National Park Service, and we are very happy to be here on the National Mall using this wonderful site framed by the U.S. Capitol, Washington Monument, and museums of the Smithsonian Institution. The festival is supported in part by federal funds, by Smithsonian Trust funds, by contributions from governments, corporations, foundations, and individuals like yourself. One way you can help contribute is by visiting our festival marketplace, which is just to the west in front of the National Museum of American History. We've got beautiful craft items made by our participants from China and from Kenya. You can also visit, if you haven't already, our food concessions. We have a food concession directly behind you called Chifan Le, Let's Eat, serving mapo tofu and dumplings lo mein, cucumber salad. And further to the east, we have two food concessions, one representing Kenyan coastal cuisine and one representing Kenyan uplands cuisine. This particular program, China Tradition and the Art of Living, is produced by the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage in partnership with the China International Culture Association, working with the China Arts and Entertainment Group. Additional support is provided by the West Kowloon Cultural District, the Hong Kong SAR, and the Guizhou Provincial Department of Culture. So, we're about to begin a session we're calling Sweet and Sour, Chinese Food in America. And today, Sunday, June 29th is our Diaspora Day. And we're very fortunate to have the support of the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center. And representing the center is Adria Luis, who is the curator of digital and emerging media on the far left here. And next to me is Cedric Ye, who is the deputy chair for the Division of Armed Forces History at the National Museum of American History. But aside from their roles at the Smithsonian, they also have deeper connections to Chinese food. So maybe I'll ask each of them to introduce themselves and tell us what is their connection to Chinese food. Maybe start with Adriel.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us today on Diaspora Day. My name is Adriel Lewis. I was born and raised in the Bay Area, California. My family's from Hong Kong, but our migration pattern kind of came through Mexico City. My grandfather and great-grandfather moved there, owned a restaurant, and then eventually they moved up to San Francisco, and then my grandfather owned a restaurant over there. And so kind of grew up eating really good Chinese food. And then I started working at Smithsonian about a year ago. Before that, I was living in Beijing. And that was actually the first time in like 3 or 4 generations that my family had actually resided in mainland China. And so it was just really interesting growing up eating what I thought was authentic Chinese food and then actually getting a taste of it. And so, yeah.
Okay, and Cedric, maybe tell us a little bit about your connections to Chinese food.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming out on what's turned out to be a lovely Sunday afternoon. I was about to apologize for the DC heat, but hey, it's not so bad. As Jim mentioned, I'm curator in the Armed Forces History Division because, as we all know, the U.S. Army loves Chinese food. But my direct connection is that I grew up in a Chinese restaurant. You know, if you ever went to takeout joint or something like that and you saw a little kid running in and around, inside and out, and then around the tables, that was basically me. And except I didn't know that there was a larger story to be told there. For me, it was just home. Recently, I had the opportunity to begin long-range research into the history of Chinese food in America, to talk about broader issues of immigration, assimilation, and entrepreneurship. And that's led me here today.
As we were preparing for this session, Cedric told me that there are more Chinese restaurants in the United States than there are McDonald's, Burger King's, and Pizza Hut's combined. So the question is, why is Chinese food so popular in the United States or around the world? Who wants to address that first? Cedric?
It's a fascinating number. I came across it was one of the first things that got my interest. It's kind of an amazing number. The last time I checked the census, it was around 50,000. If you're trying to figure out that number, everybody thinks there are Starbucks across the street from one another, two blocks away from another. You wonder why there's so many. There's only about 13,000 Starbucks in the world. All right, that's just to give you an idea. As for the question of why those you can have that many number of restaurants, that's been part of my study for the last 3 or 4 years. There's no direct answer why the popularity, but some of the ideas are this. It's always been affordable. It's always been something that people could get a full meal, full meal for your family for $20. It's always been, at least in the early stages, exotic. It gives people a sense that they're trying something from far away. But lately, it's become more predictable. It's something that we all understand. If you're moving from one coast to the next, you don't have anything in your house, you know you can ring up the local Chinese place, and you know what you can order. It's pretty much the same. It's appetizers on the left, the main course is down the middle, and then on the right side of the fold, they're probably going to have some American dishes. And you probably know what they are. So it's reached a saturation point where everyone can feel comfortable with it, and it helps generate its own forward momentum.
Yeah, Adriel, what are your thoughts on this? Why is Chinese food so popular, either in the United States, around the world, or perhaps, yeah, please.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people think about, like, cuisine and restaurants kind of from a consumer standpoint. I think one of the things about Chinese restaurants is that they're not always necessarily started by people who have a background in cuisine. And so when you think about immigration from China and people landing in and kind of what are some entry point businesses that they can open up, the ones that kind of ended up sprouting up among Chinese communities were restaurants and laundromats. And so I think part of it was almost just being hella restaurants first, and then at that point, you know, like the availability kind of gets people to want to try it out. You know, I mean, if you come to a city and you've just got like a row of Chinese restaurants and you're hungry, then you're going to try one out. And so I think that when you think about the diaspora of Chinese people, especially in the United States, you can go to really small towns. I've been to college towns where you can pretty much find like two dive bars and then like a Chinese restaurant. And I think it's almost become a thing where people in the U.S. Find it to be comfort food. You know, like Cedric said, you know, if you can't find a chain, you know, I think Chinese cuisine is one of those things that they're not necessarily connected to a chain, but you still have this common menu that you know that when you get there, there's going to be certain dishes. And they happen to be dishes most of the time that were invented in the U.S. And so I think part of it is also American Chinese cuisine is one of those cuisines that was formulated and that caters around an American palate specifically. And then so you have that kind of spread in the U.S. And then as American culture spread throughout the world, part of that is the American Chinese cuisine.
Just as an aside, and keeping in tune with my Armed Forces history background, as a little factoid, being in D.C., I meet a lot of foreign aid and military types. The first two restaurants apparently in the Green Zone in Iraq were Chinese restaurants. So, you know, they weren't American Chinese restaurants. They were just entrepreneurial Chinese families. But they probably heard that Americans like Chinese food.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, today at the Folklife Festival is Diaspora Day. And one of the, I think, interesting trends about Chinese restaurants is that you can almost use it as a timeline of immigration patterns. So who would like to sort of talk about that? I mean, how do Chinese restaurants illustrate patterns of migration, immigration, and diaspora?
Well, following what Adriel just said about Chinese restaurants being one of the only means, and they as a possibility of immigrants coming to this country. Now, there's a story behind that. There's a reason behind that, because when the earliest Chinese immigrants first arrived, they came just like everyone else did, looking for an opportunity. They started many different jobs. They were farmers. They were Well, they worked on the railroads, they were miners, they had a lot of different professions, but as time went on, the difference, their otherness, the fact that they did not blend in well with the community, they earned growing mistrust from the West Coast communities that eventually led to exclusion laws that barred more Chinese coming into the country. It made it increasingly more difficult for them to do those normal jobs. So one of the few things they could do was restaurants or laundromats, things that didn't impinge upon other community activities. It didn't feel threatening. I mean, if you didn't want to eat their food, you didn't have to go in there. So that's basically how that started, and it continues to this day, because it's become a large part of the fabric of the American experience, as countries' eating habits, that when new Chinese immigrants come here, even if they don't fit the bill, if they weren't in a restaurant business before, they could be highly trained, highly educated people who have, but no, they're going to end up working in a restaurant because that's what's available to them. And the story follows, as you mentioned, a timeline that involves the end of the exclusionary laws around World War II. What happened in between there is a fascinating story. And then, of course, the next big spike is the 1965 immigration law changes. It revolutionized the ability for immigrants coming to this country from all around the world. It brought new tastes, new flavors, including some of the more popular dishes that you probably heard from Sichuan and Hunan. It's all pretty average now, but at the time it was unbelievable. Nobody had heard of this. It was just the influx of these new flavors, and that's around when my parents came to this country too. It was during, right after the changes in those laws.
Yeah, Adriel, do you want to talk about this idea of migration, diaspora, and Chinese restaurants?
Yeah. We got like a soundtrack now. I feel like so Chinese right now talking with this. One of the interesting things about the popularity of Chinese restaurants is that the history of Chinese food in America was so much the opposite of what it is now. Like, one of the tactics, so in the late 1800s, there was a Chinese exclusion era. Chinese people as an ethnicity we're the only ethnicity where there was actually American legislation where there was a law that specifically was like, we don't want Chinese people here, right? And around that was also a lot of propaganda, cultural propaganda. One of the things in the late 1800s was that, you know, like, we don't want these Chinese people here. All they eat is rats and cats and dogs. Fortunately, those stereotypes no longer exist, right? And so that was one of the reasons why Chinese restaurants in America were very insular. You know, like in the late 1800s, early 1900s, if you went into a Chinese restaurant, you would only see Chinese people there. And the dishes were catering mostly just to Chinese folks. And so even here in DC, you would have, Sichuan restaurants, Hunan restaurants, Hong Kong restaurants, and they all had their own distinct regional cuisines. And then you have President Grant, right? So the story of President Grant is he had the Chinese prime minister over, and the prime minister brought his personal chef. And so throughout the trip, they're eating a bunch of American food. And then one day, you know, they're like, well, you know, you have your personal chef over. Why don't you try cooking us some Chinese food for us to eat, right? And the chef is like, I'm in D.C. and I'm going to find the ingredients to make some Chinese food, right? And so he just, like, put together a bunch of random ingredients, and then served it to, like, the White House. And then they ate it, and they're like, wow, this is delicious. What is it? And then the dude was like, chop suey, right? And then so they're like, wow. And then so, like, word spreads, right? All the presses go out like, oh, the president's eating Chinese food now, right? And then so people all throughout D.C. started going into these Chinese restaurants and were like, hey, do you serve chop suey? And then these restaurant owners, you know, for the first time are getting non-Chinese customers, and they're not going to, like, be like, no. So they're like, yeah, we make chop suey. And so you have all these different variations of chop suey kind of spreads throughout the U.S. And so you have these dishes like chop suey, egg foo young, beef and broccoli, sweet, probably, like, most of your favorite stuff that you would get from, like, the hot plate thing in Panda Express is, like, it comes out of this, similar stories where where these Chinese entrepreneurs are kind of testing what are the different tastes that Americans are kind of going for. And you have this negotiation, like Cedric was saying, you know, like, what can we make so that people in America will be like really into it, but at the same time they'll feel like they're eating something all like exotic, right? And then so you end up with just like meat covered in gravy, which is very American when you come to think of it.
Yeah, well, the other part of chop suey and egg fuyong is also fortune cookies, right? I mean, fortune cookies are very popular in Chinese restaurants. Do they have any relation to actual Chinese cuisine?
Yeah, if you haven't heard yet, I'm sorry to tell you, no. fortune cookies are a wholly American invention, but there are Asian influences. I hesitate to use the word recent studies, but there is a lot of evidence that shows that the fortune cookie derived from a prefecture in Japan, where they have a larger jumbo version of it. It's kind of like a big croissant. And the gentleman who has a claim to creating it here in the States was from that prefecture. And when landed in San Francisco, he wanted to have something to go along with tea in the afternoon. He had a tea house, or at least he owned a restaurant in a tea garden. And so he made a smaller version of the fortune cookie. Now, the magic question is, how does the fortune cookie end up as part of our expectations for an everyday Chinese meal if it was invented by a Japanese man? There's no real smoking gun. The idea of when it actually started being served in Chinese restaurants, we don't really know. How it started being the transfer from a Japanese creation to a Chinese one, more than likely, the theory that I have is that during World War II, almost every single Japanese American or Japanese of American Americans of Japanese ancestry were shipped off to internment camps. It's a long story, but that meant that everything they had, their businesses, their factories, gone empty. And the thought is that the Chinese then moved in, they're entrepreneurial, they started running the places, keeping the businesses going, and that led to the restaurants that were already beginning to boom. And then those were big ports. The war was going on. You have a lot of GIs from across the United States flooding through those areas. They stop for that little, like, hey, there's a row of Chinese restaurants. I'm going to stop in. They give this fortune cookie. And amazingly, you know, I don't know what you think about the taste of it, but it's got a little fortune inside. You know, oh, my God, who does that? And they go home to wherever they're from, and they ask their local restaurant, where's my fortune cookie, after they're done? And there you look at them and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Same thing with the chop suey. And eventually people get it. You mean, if that's what you want, think about it. It's free. I mean, what other restaurant ends your meal with? I guess you can get a mint or maybe like a orange wedge, but that's not the same thing. You get your fortune. My God.
Yeah, I mean, I think, just to add on to that, like, definitely, you know, when it comes to Chinese food in America, it oftentimes really comes less from like a culinary kind of like, you know, food-based standpoint, and more of just like hustlers, just being like, what will people buy? What is going to like make my business thrive? And so a lot of Chinese food has thrived from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And then as a result, Americans have become so accustomed to the taste that, you know, it just kind of like people grow up eating it and wanting it.
Not to knock our love of Chinese food. I don't want anybody to think that. I'll say it a different way. It's an interaction between those Chinese restaurant owners. It was the only way of living almost for good 65 years. They had almost no choice but to open up restaurants. And if that was your only job, essentially, then you're going to try to develop ways to interact with the community. And I would say that that's the key word there, interact. They did not, as some people would say, that I am not necessarily of the camp that said that this is that there's something less about Chinese food as we know it today because it's not authentic. I mean, it is very much American. I don't like to add any other hyphens after it. They did not meet those immigrants when they came off the boat in 1850 and say, give me all your recipes, and then for the next 100 years they messed them up, and then they gave them back recently and said, ha, what are you going to do? It was a constant interaction between the customers and the owners of those restaurants to create something that would sell, that you would enjoy, and it's a part of all of our stories.
For those of you who've just recently joined us, this is a session we're calling Sweet and Sour, Chinese Food in America. And with us are Cedric Ye from the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and Adriel Lewis from the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center. Adriel, you were telling us earlier that you recently lived in Beijing before coming to the Smithsonian, and you've noticed that some of the restaurants in Beijing may be adapting or transforming based upon American-style Chinese food. Could you share some of your thoughts about that with us?
Yeah, so I was living in Beijing before I moved to D.C., and I've had a harder time finding good Chinese food in D.C. than I had finding good American food in China. But I was living in the Third Ring, in an area that is heavily expat. And so actually, when you look out the window, there's like a pizza spot, a pasta spot, a brick oven pizza spot, and like KFC. KFC's everywhere, hella KFC's, right? And so I had trouble finding like Chinese food in my neighborhood, actually. I had to like hop on a train, kind of like in D.C. But you know, I think one of the interesting things, especially in these expat areas, is you have like this meta Chinese food, which is because you have a lot of foreigners living in the neighborhoods that move to China and get freaked out by real Chinese food, and they're like, you know, where's my orange chicken? They start cooking orange chicken up in China, right? And so you would go to these places where they would serve the Chinese food that, you know, like, so typically, like, you could get a good meal in China of like real delicious clean Chinese food for like maybe like $4 or $5 US dollars. But you would go into these really fancy restaurants, they would sit you down, and then you could order like sweet and sour chicken for like $15 US, right? And yeah, it was like American style Chinese food cooked by Chinese chefs who grew up cooking actual Chinese food. And so it kind of tastes a little bit better than American Chinese food, but at the same time, it was weird, yeah, because you get your fortune cookie at the end, you know, like they decorate it all like, you know, with these lanterns and things like that, which, you know, you actually don't really get when you go to like a local Beijing restaurant. And so it's really interesting because I think on New York Times they were writing an article about now there are these restaurants that are actually like marketing themselves, and you know, you have these now you have these Americans moving to China because they spent some time living in China, now moving back to China and then creating American Chinese food for Chinese people who want to eat like the expats, and so they're going to these American Chinese restaurants in China ordering American Chinese food so that they can eat like the foreigners that they see eating it.
Yeah, I recently gave an interview for the National China Daily because Panda Express is opening their first restaurant there. So that's fantastic. And another factoid, you know, they tried marketing, exporting fortune cookies back in the 80s, but that failed miserably because no one understood why their cookies had pieces of paper inside. The locals were just confused and stopped buying them.
Well, I'm sure members of our audience have questions they would like to ask our panelists. Yeah, Randy? Yeah, the question is, for the Chinese Americans who've been living here a long time, do they prefer Chinese American food, Chinese food, or perhaps some combination of the two?
It's the same for any immigrant group. They like the food from their own countries. So yes, as I'm sure Adriel would attest to, back home they cook whatever it is that they're used to. So as children of immigrants, I'm a first generation kid, I ate what my parents ate. But that changed after a while because there's only so much that working parents can do for a kid. And I ate like anybody else growing up. I had hot dogs, hamburgers. And my parents learned about my grandfather. He was born in the Qing Dynasty. I remember him taking me to my first McDonald's. You know, and it's any other immigrant story. The line is pretty much the same. Wherever your folks are from, they will prefer to eat home cooking.
Yeah, I mean, so my parents are both from Hong Kong, and when I was a kid, you know, like, I grew up in the Bay Area, and so there were Chinese restaurants, like, down the street, you know, a 5-minute drive away, but sometimes it'd be, like, Thursday night, and they'd be like, we're gonna go get, Hong Kong food. And then we drive for like an hour, 45 minutes. And I was a kid, I was like, why are we driving so far, right? Now, after I've spent some time living in China, I'm like, that's why, because it's so much better. And they would like miss it. And it's like sometimes same thing in Virginia and Maryland. Like sometimes you might come across like a Chinese restaurant or any other kind of Asian restaurant, like that's like really in the cuts. Like there's no way that you would have just stumbled upon it, and then you see it, and then it's just like filled with people. And it's like, how do that's kind of like the word of mouth. And it's like the folks who grow up eating really authentic Asian food, when they find a spot that kind of fits it as closely as they can, like they'll gravitate towards it to tell all their homies. You know, it's like we've been doing Yelp since before the internet. So.
Yes, in the back. Yeah, the question is, if I want to order an authentic Chinese dish, what might you recommend as authentically Chinese?
I think the best way to say that is, as Adriel mentioned, there are centers. I try to stay away from this authenticity question because I think that's more of a question of cuisine. And that's fine if you're looking for that. My work and my studies have taken me towards like how the story progresses in terms of how the menu can be used as a timeline, as we mentioned earlier. But to address your question, you would want to go to one of the centers where there are more new immigrants. So their restaurants would be catering, like the early Chinese immigrants in the 1850s, to the community. So if you go there and you order off the menu there, there's a chance that it still is a menu that caters mainly to the people in the community and hasn't yet been experienced or adapted as a business, as Adriel has also mentioned, to the tastes of their a wider range of customers. You probably won't get that in a regular restaurant. Most average restaurants are just going to have the menus that that do well, and asking won't really change anything. I would give you one cautionary tale. I had a friend of mine who did like to explore and enjoy, and they went into a Chinese restaurant, and it was down home. It had nothing but Chinese everywhere, and they were like, this is where I want to be, and they pointed at one item, and they pointed at another, and the waiter looked at them and said, are you sure? And they said, come on, bring it on. I am not concerned. They said, look, really, I'm just asking. Really? They're like, I'm not afraid. I'm going to enjoy this. You just watch. He came back with two of the same dish. They were on different parts of the menu. So, you know, just be a little cautious.
Yeah, but, I mean, you'll find some restaurants where there's, like, the English menu. And then if you recognize everything on there, then you know you got, like, the menu for, like, the non-Chinese people. And then, like, usually you'll see, like, all these Chinese characters like all over the wall, right? Like if you point to something like that, there's probably a lot of dishes that it's not necessarily that it's something that you would find disgusting or anything, but it's something that oftentimes these restaurant owners, they, especially if they're catering towards Americans as well as Chinese customers, they'll have two separate menus, and then they'll kind of like, based out of their own reference, be like, okay, you know, I'll put in English the things that I'm gonna assume that Americans are going to want to eat, and then I'm not going to even bother translating the things that I'm going to assume that they're not going to want to eat. But if you're interested in trying it and you're not worried about, you know, like, you know, ending up with an unconventional body part, which is typically what I prefer. I mean, I know that, you know, if you do find something that's like kind of translated, like they were like having a really rough time trying to translate in English, that's probably like more on the side of something that you'll get, you know, that a Chinese customer will order, because, you know, like they had like a really difficult time trying to explain it in English while still making it sound appetizing. You could also just like order the English translated item that sounds the most disgusting. It's probably the most delicious thing on the menu. And I would say, yeah, like, you know, everybody kind of knows the rule of like, if you go to a Chinese restaurant and you don't see any Chinese people eating there, then you probably shouldn't eat there either. Sometimes, like, my fiance and I will, like, try a restaurant, and then we'll see people, like, look through the window and then see us and come in and, like, eat because they saw us, and we're like, no, we're just trying this. It's actually not that good, so.
Once again, I apologize to any Chinese restaurants we might be taking business away. I would like to point out once again that, you know, for my take, it's food that we you didn't get to 50,000 restaurants because we were looking for the one real one, all right? We do have real ones. They're everywhere. All of those are real. There is no, like, you know, if you want to find something that has more, authentic is such a loaded word. If you want to look for that, fine. But the Chinese restaurants that dot our landscape, they're perfectly fine. I enjoyed them growing up as much as I liked the Big Mac. So, you know, beef and broccoli was how my mom got me to eat vegetables. You know, and as Adriel said, that's not, you can't find broccoli or they don't make that in China. But I loved it. So, you know, and keep on going. It's good stuff.
Yes, question here. Yeah, your comment is that as a Chinese student, when she goes to Chinese restaurants, she will tell the owner, you know, I want the food prepared in the Chinese way. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question is whether there was a backlash to the Chinese entrepreneurs creating Chinese restaurants.
I don't know. That's another one of those in that moment when they were first trying. But as Adriel was explaining and I mentioned briefly, that exclusionary period where Chinese restaurants really took hold is hard to explain. It was devastating. Think about it. I mean, you all have your immigration stories. You know where your parents came from. You know that there's a background. There's a community that came from Northern Europe, Africa, wherever it might be, Asia. But just imagine if they said no more. All right, so that meant, in theory, those that were in this country were gone. They were dying. Most of the ones who migrated here were men. They came here for work. You would eventually, after a generation or two, just evaporate. There wasn't no one else coming in. There was a trickle of high-level, like, merchants and diplomats and things like that, businessmen. But your communities were almost all men. They were ostracized to begin with. Now you have a law in place that says, and if this is the one business you can do, you will do whatever it takes to stay open, to serve, and there's just this amazing, like, I'm amazed at what was going on. But Adriel mentioned chop suey. Chop suey, I like to think of it as a savior. Other scholars, there's no real documentation, but the rise of chop suey was right in the heart of that exclusionary period. Americans loved chop suey. There was an explosion of chop houses, is what they call them. They went from, say, New York as an example. The census that showed restaurants in the late 1890s, 1900s, there were maybe 40 Chinese restaurants. By the end, at the beginning of the 1900s, there were 200. All right, and it's because people just absolutely had to have this, and it might have saved the community. It gave them an opportunity to survive when there really wasn't a lot of options. But you know, if you're just trying to stay alive, I don't think anybody would be saying, "Why are you serving that? That's not, you know." I mean, he's just glad that he's making a buck.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, also a lot of the entrepreneurs were sending money back to China, and so I don't think people in China were having a problem with that. I think also, I mean, the food, the American Chinese food, in many ways is just like so different from the types of cuisine that you would get in different parts of China that it almost doesn't really feel like a bastardization. And I think one of the things to clarify is like, you know, when I the first time I went to China, I was like concerned. I was like, China's so big, and if it's all Chinese restaurants, how do they all cook the same thing? And I realized, you know, like China is such a huge country. There's so many regions, and so there's not just like there's no restaurant really that is like Chinese food. You know, you have Yunnan food, you have Sichuan food, you have Hunan food, you have Hong Kong food, you have Macau food, you have Taiwanese food, and so you know, there is like a huge variety of restaurants. You can go into a mall and there'll be a food court of like 20 restaurants and they'll all serve different things even though they're all different kinds of Chinese food. And so when you come out here, especially the restaurants that are catering towards Americans, they're just still trying to wrap their heads around Chinese being, you know, like one kind of Asian, right? And so, you know, like it's a long shot to be like, nah, nah, we're this kind of Chinese. And so as a result, I think that this kind of amalgamated Chinese food is something that like no one particular region I think would like feel personally offended about. I mean that's an assumption on my end. I think as a result you kind of get like it almost feels like a top 40 sometimes when you look at the menu. You've got like Mongolian beef, right? And you've got like, you know, like Hunan shrimp, and you've got all these like food items that are named after one region, like as if in Mongolia all they eat is like Mongolian beef, right? And so yeah, I mean I think that again, it was during the time, it's just like the validation, you know, like when you're in a period where there's just so much xenophobia, and then you actually start getting customers from the communities that have been ostracizing you, like that validation I think is enough to kind of override any kind of feeling of like people are trying to water down my culture.
Okay, other questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, the question is based on his experience at a hotel in Mexico, wondering about what might be a traditional Chinese breakfast.
Yeah, it's a lot different, sort of, than here. Although the oatmeal, it's not oatmeal, it's just watery rice. Now that could be, you would be like, hey, that's like oatmeal. But yes, they have pastries. It's usually, the places in China that I went to, it's usually kind of salty. There'll be little dishes of salted vegetables, maybe some peanuts, pickled vegetables, things like that. A version of oatmeal is ran out of rice, some pastries, and I'm trying to remember, and you've been there more recently. Did you have a lot of breakfast?
It'll be usually be like kind of greasy, really greasy stuff. I mean, especially from Hong Kong, you have like, if you ever, you know, like you see like the congee, which is like the rice porridge, and then they'll serve it with like, they usually call it, in America, they'll call it like fried Chinese donut. It's like quite delicious because it's fried dough. But have you seen Mulan? You've seen Mulan. I've seen Mulan, right? And like there's that scene where like the Eddie Murphy dragon is like being like, breakfast time, Mulan. And then it's like a bowl of rice with like eggs and bacon. It's like, that's not what they eat in China. So yeah, I mean, I think pastries is something that Chinese folks, particularly, I mean, definitely in Hong Kong because of the European influence, like, they've definitely taken it on. So you have, like, these, like, egg custard tarts, you know, like, Chinese wedding cake is, like, you see this influence from, like, Western culture, Parisian culture, things like that. But pastries themselves have not necessarily been something that have been customarily, like, a breakfast dish. It typically will be pretty greasy and salty and kind of heavy because when you think about like, you know, rural China, like you got to eat something pretty heavy because you have to go out and like work in the fields for a really long time.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, our time has come to a close, but I'd like maybe a nice round of applause for Adriel Lewis and Cedric Yeh talking about sweet and sour Chinese food in America. Don't go away because coming up is a very exciting session. Actually, speaking of restaurants, this particular session is being co-sponsored by Busboys and Poets. And the topic, in keeping with our Diaspora Day theme, is African and Asian spoken word. Also like to call your attention that this evening at 6 p.m. in the Moonrise Pavilion right behind you should be a very exciting concert with performers Abigail Washburn and the Shanghai Restoration Project. But Please stay tuned for African Asian Diaspora Spoken Word, and I'll turn the microphone over to my co-curator, Sojin Kim.
Thank you again to Jim, Cedric, and Adriel. Fantastic session. And as Jim said, we're going to continue the theme of diaspora now.